from Matthew 12, beginning at verse 1. This is the word of the Lord. At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples were hungry, and they began to pluck heads of grain and to eat. When the Pharisees saw it, they said, "Look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath." And he said to them, "Have you not read what David did when he was hungry, and those who were with him, how he entered the house of God and ate the bread of the presence, which it was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who were with him, but only for the priests? Or have you not read in the law how on the Sabbath the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are guiltless? I tell you, something greater than the temple is here, and if you had known what this means, 'I desire mercy and not sacrifice,' you would not have condemned the guiltless. For the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath." He went on from there and entered their synagogue, and a man was there with a withered hand, and they asked him, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?" So they might accuse him. And he said to them, "Which one of you who has a sheep, if it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will not take hold of it and lift it out? Of how much more value is a man than a sheep? So it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath." And then he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." And the man stretched it out, and it was restored, healthy like the other. But the Pharisees went out and conspired against him, how to destroy him. This has been the reading of God's word. Please be seated. In every Presbyterian church that I have been a part of, which is three, the vast majority of people in those churches were not raised Presbyterian. This isn't always true, of course. I have friends who are either in churches or they are pastoring churches where that's really not true. I have friends that sit on sessions, what we call kind of our group of elders. They sit on sessions in typically other parts of the country with third and fourth generation Presbyterian ruling elders. So the story goes, daddy was an elder and granddaddy was an elder and great-great-great-granddaddy was an elder. It's a beautiful legacy. Many of us are figuring out, though, what does it mean to be Presbyterian? And in my experience, this means that nothing is more radical and controversial than a Reformed and Presbyterian understanding of the Christian Sabbath or the Lord's Day. Now, baptism can be a hurdle for some. The structure of the worship service might take some getting used to, but Sunday as a unique day of worship and rest, Sunday as a day that is different from Monday through Saturday, is something that just feels so alien. Now, this country, by and large, has a strange relationship with the Sabbath. I remember living in Chicago over a decade ago, and we're talking downtown Chicago. This is not the Bible Belt by any stretch of the imagination, and we're at Costco at 11 a.m. on Sunday, and all of the alcohol is covered in blue tarps. Can't buy alcohol until 12 noon, which of course is familiar in many states and counties within states. In fact, you can't buy alcohol in just about every county in the state of Mississippi on Sunday. You can't buy cars on Sunday in New Jersey, Illinois, Maryland, Iowa, Minnesota, North Dakota, Oklahoma, or Texas. You can't race horses in Illinois on Sunday. You can't buy a mattress in the state of Washington on Sunday. And among the more strange laws, and I had many to choose from, but this is my favorite, you are not allowed to parachute in Florida on Sundays if you are a single woman. It's crazy. And so on the one hand, we have these strange laws on the books in parts of this country that don't permit certain behaviors on this day, but that pushes up, it comes into conflict with the far more prevalent understanding of this day. It's just Saturday part two. It's a day of family and fun. Maybe some household chores are thrown in, but those are for Saturday because Sunday, of course, is fun day. It's not uncommon for retailers and businesses to make 35 to 50% of their week's profits on Sundays alone. American football is still by far the most popular American sport. Churches offer Saturday night services so they don't get in the way of our Sunday plans. What do we do with this? What do we do with Sundays? Is there still such a thing as a Sabbath that we need to observe? And I think, uncontroversially, I hope I'm a Presbyterian minister, I do. I think it's one of the most important topics of our age. Why is that? The 20th century was dubbed the age of anxiety. What's the 21st century age going to be dubbed as? The age of more anxiety? The age of panic? The age of despair and hopelessness? It's the age where everything feels like it is hanging by a thread. It's the age of anger. It's the age of rage. It's the age of despair. It's the age of busyness and exhaustion. And all along, we're asking the question, do we have to do something different on the Sabbath? Because the Sabbath does get in the way, because it reminds us we have limits. It reminds us we can't do it on our own. It reminds us to stop so that we can actually receive from the Lord. Do we have to observe the Sabbath is a strange question in the age of despair and anxiety. I think it's something like watching a horrific car accident after horrific car accident in a single intersection and wondering if the traffic light still applies to me. This is what it's like to live in an anxious age and wonder, is a Sabbath relevant? So our passage this morning sets out to, it's not setting out to discuss the Sabbath. It uses the Sabbath as a backdrop to describe who Jesus is. And yet if Jesus isn't just the one who points us to life, but is life itself, then in Jesus we learn how to live. And this includes the idea of Sabbath. So this morning, what we'll look at is what does the Sabbath mean in light of Jesus being the Lord of the Sabbath? At 3 points this morning, we see the Sabbath transformed, the Sabbath restored, and finally the Sabbath applied. So 3 points this morning, the Sabbath transformed, the Sabbath restored, and the Sabbath applied. All right, there's a beautiful little thematic link between Matthew 11 and the end of chapter 12, because Jesus just said what we looked at last week, right? The most like spectacular verse in all of the Bible, if you ask me, come who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Flip to chapter 12, and what are we looking at? Sabbath, rest. How do we rest in Jesus, who has this burden that is bearable, this burden that is light that can be received? And these two scenes revolving around the Sabbath that we just read, they set the scene for an entire chapter that is really about the increasing opposition to Jesus by the religious leaders that will eventually send him to the cross. The scene picks up with Jesus and his disciples, and they're taking a casual Saturday stroll through the grain fields. There's no starvation. There's no urgent need to eat. The picture of the disciples who are hanging out, their stomachs start grumbling, and so they start to pick some heads of grain and eat them. The Pharisees see this, and they say to Jesus, because Jesus is their leader, Jesus is their rabbi, he's in charge of his students and his followers, and they're caught snacking. Look, your disciples are doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath. Remember, the Pharisees are not the bad guys wearing the black cowboy hats. They are the religious leaders. They are in charge of the local synagogues. They have a passion for the Torah. And they also, and this is really important when you understand the Pharisees, they have a passion for maintaining a unique Jewish identity in a foreign land. It shouldn't be foreign, but it is when it's under Roman rule. So they're holding together national identity. That's really important. The current opposition revolving around the Sabbath is no small matter, but of enormous importance for maintaining a cultural identity. The Sabbath was central to Israel. Other surrounding nations had sacrifices. Other surrounding nations had temples. They had circumcision even, but the calendar was different. No other calendar aligned with Israel's calendar. The Sabbath was instituted at creation. We finished a Sunday school series in the book of Leviticus, and we had to go back to creation to understand Leviticus. And so when God puts the luminaries in the sky, the point is not a 24-hour calendar that's being initiated. The point is for feast days, Sabbaths, festivals. The pinnacle of creation isn't humanity created. It's humanity dwelling in Sabbath fellowship with their God. We're all trying to get to that seventh day. In Exodus, God redeems a people who are being crushed by slavery, and he offers them a Sabbath escape. Eventually, they're put into exile, and the Sabbath takes on even more significance. Now God's people are deprived of temple, they're deprived of their city, they're deprived of their land, but they can cling to their calendar. They can cling to the Sabbath. Enter Jesus and his followers. According to the religious leaders, that very act of picking grain poses a threat to this sacred day. As important as the Sabbath law was, there are few actual details given in the Old Testament of how to keep it. A couple of them would be you can't gather sticks and you can't kindle fire, but there was no explicit definition of work given. And so in step the Pharisees, how do we maintain this national identity? How do we maintain faithfulness? And so what they did was they wanted to make sure no one accidentally violated the Sabbath. And so they set up a fence around the law. An example would be you can only walk so far and still be considered a Sabbath keeper. What kind of emergency care can you offer to someone in need on the Sabbath? What kind of food preparation was lawful on the Sabbath? None of this in the law, but all of it a fence to keep us from violating the law. And in steps Jesus and his crew, and in the most mundane way, they blow right through the fence. How does Jesus transform the Sabbath? That's our first point. How does Jesus transform the day? He makes it about him. This first dispute with his opponents is all focused on his authority. And so he answers to the Bible teachers, to the Bible scholars of his day, haven't you read in your Bibles? You don't play that game with the word incarnate. And yet his argument from the Bible isn't compiling data. He's not compiling proof texts to support the behavior of his disciples. His argument is that he is the most authoritative thing they have ever seen. Everything great in their Bibles that they cherish, everything they respect, everything they use to establish an identity is lesser than the one they are standing before. It's no surprise they plot to kill him. First example comes from history, from King David's life. This is a weird example. It's a weird argument. In 1 Samuel 21, David and his men are hungry, and so they come to the temple. And they eat the showbread. This is 12 loaves of bread that are stacked high on the table. A big menorah shines on top of the bread. And it's all this symbolic reality that God's presence shines in grace upon these 12 tribes of Israel, symbolized through this bread. Once the bread was done and the priest had to bake new bread and bring in the new bread, then the priest could eat the bread. But David and his men are hungry. He's just the king. He has some followers. He walks in and says, I want the bread. And he eats the bread that was for the priests. David has the audacity to march into the temple, take the bread, and eat it. What's Jesus' point in using this story? David got away with doing that for one reason. He was David. That's Jesus' argument. It's a strange argument. That's it. David got away with it because of how great David was. And so if the law could be broken, if it could be slipped to the side by Israel's greatest king, then who else are we talking about? Who else can break it? His point is someone greater than David is here. That's Jesus' point. His next argument in verse 5, or haven't you read in the law that the priests on Sabbath duty in the temple desecrate the Sabbath and yet are innocent? This is a clear argument. He says, priests work on the Sabbath, don't they? My men can't pluck grain, and yet we got priests right now, Pharisees, who are in the temple, who are preparing and butchering the sacrifices. They're changing the bread. They're changing the oil. And so Jesus gets feisty and says, there are priests in the temple who are profaning the Sabbath, and yet they are guiltless in your eyes. They were guiltless in Jesus' eyes, of course, too. Why? Because the authority of the temple and the priesthood is greater than even the authority of the Sabbath. And so Jesus has a second argument. I tell you that one greater than the temple is here. If there is one single idea or reason that gets Jesus crucified, it might be this one, that Jesus is greater than the temple. The temple where God meets with his people, the symbolic place of God's dwelling. And Jesus says, I am greater. In Jesus, in this guy who is walking through grain fields, God really and truly is dwelling with his people. Think back to your Old Testaments, all of the details spent setting up the tabernacle, which would become the temple. How will a sinful humanity dwell with a holy God? Jesus of Nazareth far surpassed anything the temple represented. He is the true mediator between God and his people. You're worried about prohibitions and permissions, and you are meeting with God who is dwelling right before you. Something greater is here. Someone greater than David, something greater than the temple, and then maybe the most outrageous claim Jesus makes, and by the way, the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. You want to talk about the Sabbath? Just understand that I'm the boss of the Sabbath. Do you see how that's the most controversial thing he said? Where does the Sabbath go back to? It's not to the wilderness. It's not trying to institute some kind of religious cult for Israel. The Sabbath goes back to creation, instituted by God, and Jesus says, yeah, that's me. I am Lord over this entire thing. I am Lord over the very purpose of creation. It's a veiled way of saying that through him all things were made, and without him nothing was made that was made. A veiled way. I am Lord of the Sabbath. Sabbath is transformed because it's all about him. In Jesus, we find the mediator that brings us to God. In him, we find the rest that we're looking for. He transforms the Sabbath by making the Sabbath about him. Our second point is that Jesus restores the Sabbath. He goes back to the heart of the Sabbath. The scene changes from the grain fields to the synagogue in verse 9. Jesus and his disciples go where everyone else in town would naturally be going on the Sabbath, the local synagogue. Matthew describes this interestingly, though. He says Jesus went to their synagogue. It's worth noting because geographically, this is just as much Jesus' synagogue as anybody, and yet you can already see the separation that's growing between Jesus and the religious leaders. Instead of catching Jesus in a potentially a compromised position, the religious leaders this time present him with a test. There's a man in the synagogue, presumably worshiping, and their intention is seeking to find a way to accuse Jesus. And so they ask, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? Matthew gives us just a few words describing the scene. What I want to focus on with you now is how evil the Pharisees' action is. There is a man who is already in the house of the Lord. He is there to worship. There is a man who seeks to be guided by God's law. He is there to receive God's blessing. And those who are the leaders of this place, those who are the shepherds of this man, those who are there for his spiritual care, they use him. They use him as an object lesson. He's described as having a shriveled hand. This isn't just a bummer for the guy. It's not just that it's kind of ugly looking. It means that he probably has a hard time working because he can't use both hands. And they pull him out. They say, come on, we need you for a second. This is evil. Jesus, theoretically, would you even break God's law in order to heal this guy's hand? Their implied answer of the Pharisees is that God would rather this man be unhealed. God would rather this man not be able to feed himself so that this day can stay holy. It's evil. And what's crazy is Jesus could have given the most vanilla answer you can imagine. He could have spiritually tended to that man with a shriveled hand, right? He could have put his arm around him and he could have loved on him and he could have worshiped God. And he said, "You'll first thing tonight when the sun goes down, let's heal your hand." And Jesus says, "I'm not playing the game." They're more interested in squashing Jesus than liberating a man who is broken. So Jesus answers in two ways. He's not going to play their game. He identifies the false love of the Pharisees and then he restores the purpose of the Sabbath. What does it mean to identify the false love of the Pharisees? It means that the absolute best lovers of human beings will be lovers of God. You will poorly love other people if you don't love God rightly. This is humbling for all of us. Can you imagine a non-Christian who you're having a discussion with? And I've had plenty of these with non-Christians who, if I said that, they would say, that's stupid. Of course you don't need to be a Christian to love well. You don't need to be a Christian in order to be a good person, and that's true. But you also don't need to believe in gravity to be anchored to the ground. And furthermore, it's humbling because I just said the best lovers of people are lovers of God, which means that the key to Christianity must be something than my own personal love, and it is. It's trusting in the one who did love God perfectly and loved people perfectly. And by grace, I'm seeking that one. Jesus is diagnosing the disorder. There's a little verse in Luke 16 that I don't hear talked about much, and it's wonderful in terms of the hearts of the Pharisees. See, Jesus is warning about the love of money, and a familiar passage that I'm sure many of us know, even if you did not, if you haven't spent any time at church, you've probably heard this, you can't love God and money, or the old fashioned way of saying it, you can't love God and mammon. And then Luke has commentary on that passage. Luke says, the Pharisees who loved money heard all of this and were sneering at Jesus. The Pharisees who loved money heard all of this and were sneering at Jesus. They used God to justify themselves. They used God to establish their own superiority and their power and control. Jesus is a threat, but he is not a threat to their holiness. That's what they'd have you believe. He's a threat to their power. Man, that sounds familiar. The Pharisees' love of money is on display, even in our passage, why I brought it up. Verse 11, Jesus says, "If any of you has a sheep and it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will you not take hold of it and lift it out?" And then Jesus gives us this theological insight. How much more valuable is a human being than a sheep? Incomparably. Therefore, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. Jesus gets them where it hurts. You will make sure you don't lose a commodity on the Sabbath. You will make sure you don't lose property on the Sabbath. But you will hold religious duty over the heads of your people who are in need. If it affects your bottom line, you might make an exception. But if it's about the healing of someone else, well, there are rules, Jesus. He calls them out for their priorities. He calls them out for their disordered loves. And then he restores the purpose. Two words that summarize the heart of the Sabbath. Don't miss this. Two words if you want to identify what does the Sabbath mean and what does it entail. The two words are mercy and goodness. Those are the two words Jesus gives us. Mercy and goodness, which is fascinating. As I was writing this out last week, all of a sudden the word association took me right to Psalm 23. Lord is my shepherd. How will it end if the Lord is my shepherd? Surely goodness and mercy will follow me. If your Sabbath isn't shaped by mercy toward others, then something other than the gospel is driving you. If the Sabbath is something you do and not something you receive, then you would rather the broken stay broken so that you can maintain your idea of wholeness. But it's not about your wholeness. It's about you knowing that you're broken and that you're leaking and that you're struggling and that you need to receive grace. It's about mercy. Mercy received and then mercy poured out. If the Sabbath isn't about doing good, if it isn't about in faith loving God and loving others, then you have lost the purpose of the Sabbath. It was always a gift for God's creatures. It was always a gift for the tired and anxious. It was always a gift for the unsettled and frantic. It was always a gift intended to remind us that we are not enough in and of ourselves, that we are creatures with limits and boundaries with virtually no control. But he is infinite, and he is eternal, and he is sovereign and good and loving. If we forget mercy and goodness, then any talk of God's law and of righteousness and religion becomes antichrist. After all, the Pharisees witness life-restoring healing, and they plot how they can destroy him. The preacher Ray Ortland, commenting on this passage, says, "They sought to destroy the life-giver for the sake of religion. Our moral fervor is the worst thing about us." Moral fervor that we see every day of the week. Moral fervor that is written on our DNA. That's what we say often here, right? The law is our natural language. The law is what is inscribed on our DNA. The problem, of course, it's not even God's law that we uphold. It's the laws of our own imagination. But moral fervor is our native language. If you have children and they are siblings, then you know this. Because it is all about justice, and it is all about moral fervor. And we look at that and we say, kids are so obsessed with justice because mom and dad are also obsessed with our ideas of justice too. Moral fervor is everywhere. It's a moral fervor that shapes our political context, where every policy is righteous versus the unrighteous. It's a moral fervor that shapes our understanding of ourselves in light of others. And moral fervor is soul-crushing because it's exhausting. You can see why this follows Jesus' call to take his yoke, which is easy and light. Jesus restores a Sabbath that is part of the yoke he offers because it was always about him. Sabbath is transformed. The Sabbath is restored. Goodness and mercy is the heart of it. What in the world does that mean for us right now? What does it mean for us in our society of blue laws? Blue laws, the government, it's some places and sometimes they use to uphold the good of the people, to help them find rest. It's an interesting question. I've been fascinated because about 4 years ago, the country of Poland instituted no trade day on Sunday. And the reason was kind of religious, but the bigger reason was sociological. It was saying our people are ruining themselves. And now there are efforts to end no trade day on Sunday. But it's an effort from the government to uphold the good of the people. It's why I would say the Ten Commandments is grounded in creation. It's good news. I mean, it's not good news. It's bad news. We don't keep it. But it's good for our souls. It's the good life to have a day of rest. But what does that mean for us in our society of blue laws that buck up against Sunday fun day? There are plenty of churches in town that love the Lord. They seek to follow him. They love Jesus. They read their Bibles, and they would say, Jesus has fulfilled the Sabbath. There's no more Sabbath. There's no holy day set apart for following him and observing a day of rest. I would argue, and I'd say most churches say this. Most churches believe this. We have 10 commandments that make a lot of sense, and then we have that pesky fourth one that gets in the way. I don't want to go there. I think we can pull out of our passage what it means to observe a Sabbath united to the one who is the Lord of the Sabbath. Our last point, how does this apply to us, right? First of all, first application, there is no Sabbath apart from Jesus himself. There is no Sabbath apart from Jesus himself. When I was a kid, it wasn't uncommon to take Sunday drives. Did any of you take Sunday drives, right? You get in the car and you drive to no particular place in the age of the automobile and cheaper fuel prices. I wanted to say that because it makes it seem like I'm like a different era, right? I know many of you did the same, right? You just got into a drive, you just drove somewhere. Jesus and his disciples are on a Sunday stroll. You know how we know that? Because there was a law of how far you could travel and they're not being accused of that. They're meandering. They're local. They get hungry and they start picking the grain. They're hanging out doing what other first century friends would do. And I love that because right there we have that glimpse, don't we? The disciples that day are experiencing a Sabbath of Sabbaths. They're hanging out with Jesus. There's one day for us to stop and breathe and ask, am I spending time? Am I delighting in Jesus? And then it's beautiful. Because we read this debate between Jesus and his opponents, and yet what is the point of the debate? How does it get started? It's Jesus having his disciples back. Jesus is being his disciples' advocate. He has our backs. Jesus is the advocate in our passage, and he's the healer. Jesus is the one who silences accusers and then tends to our hurt. And so do you see the odd question of whether or not we should observe the Sabbath? The discussion turns into a list of what can I do? What am I allowed to do? What's prohibited? What's allowed? And it's never about the need of the joy of his presence. And maybe after a week of being accused by the enemy and being accused by others and being accused by my own sin-tainted conscience, maybe after a week of letting others and myself down, maybe after a week of struggling with sin and temptation, maybe after a week of a to-do list that stares back at me and calls me a failure, maybe after a week of feeling condemned, maybe after a week of poor parenting, the best thing I could do is spend time with my advocate. In my brokenness, I can feel refreshed in his healing. See, Jesus restored that day the reality that the Sabbath was always about refreshment and not human scruples. We have an even better refreshment day, not just through his restoring work, but through his transforming work. The Sabbath is a weekly reminder, and we don't talk about this enough, it's a weekly reminder that we long for a greater rest. This is revealed to us. The normal human impulse, apart from God's revealed world, is more cyclical. It cycles. And so life is a cycle. And so you go back to the ancient philosophers, and they were all arguing about, does the cycle continue eternally, or will the cycle one day stop? And then you have the 20th century, where just about everyone, beginning with Einstein, said, no, it's pretty certain that the cycle will stop. And Christianity and biblical religion from the beginning has said, no, life is not a cycle. Life has an end. It has a telos. It has a goal, and the goal is Sabbath. And this matters even this side of the cross. It's a day where we long for something better than this. Whatever this is. Commutes, carpools, work, whatever this is, we long for something better. And Sunday is the reminder that that longing for something better is completely normal. You were created for that. Jesus, of course, would transform the Sabbath through his own resurrection. It's no longer a day of rest on the seventh day after a week of exhausting work and worldly trials and obstacles, but now it's a day of rest on the first day before we ever lift a finger. A day that our calendars say, weekly, in Jesus, you are enough before you ever do a thing. In Jesus, you are enough before you ever do a thing. That's what it means for Jesus to move the day from Saturday to Sunday. You and I need a day to receive this gift of Sabbath for what it is. It's a gift of refreshment. It's a gift of refreshment that's not offered in a good meal and a great bottle of wine. Those are great things. And if you say, well, what day should I have a great meal and a great bottle? Make it Sunday. In the Riccio house, that's the day we have dessert for sure. Sunday. But we need a better rest than that. It's not a gift of refreshment of a long walk on the beach. What a privilege it is, right, to be able to, later this afternoon, go to the beach and have a walk. But that, too, is not the refreshment that we need. It's a day to drink from the water that satisfies. The story shows us, first of all, the Sabbath is about spending time with Jesus. It's a gift of God to refresh us, to sustain us. Secondly, this is a second application. The story shows us the Sabbath isn't just about me. It's not just about us. It's a day to celebrate, and I would say also, it's a day to pursue mercy. Jesus shows us that this day was never about exhibiting religious discipline. It was about celebrating the mercy of God. It was never a day about looking into castigating the weakness of others, right? That's like Sabbath keeping at its worst, is looking at others and seeing how they are violating the Sabbath according to your own law code. It's a day about celebrating the gospel. It's about the gospel of the God who sent his only son out of mere grace and mercy. It's about how this whole story isn't about how we can ascend to him, but how he descended to us, and with a voice using ordinary vocal cords and air, he spoke words of life, and with human skin, with hard calluses and unmanicured fingernails, he touched untouchables, and he showed us this vision of a kingdom of foot washing. It's the story of how human blood, magnificently called the blood of God by Paul in the book of Acts, was shed for the forgiveness of our sins. It's a day of mercy and goodness that will surely follow us all the days of our lives. Pastorally, I typically will never give you a list of what you can and cannot do on the Lord's Day. I won't give you blue law spirituality. But I will give you the illustration I gave you that I began with. It's like watching horrific car accident after horrific car accident in a particular intersection and pulling up and wondering, does that traffic light apply to me? This church family is not void of discontent, anxiety, depression, restlessness, doubt, and despair. It's not void of those things because your pastor shares in those things. Let's not overlook this gift. Sunday is absolutely for spending time with your family. And yet God's vision of the good life says that you will love them best only from a place of rest. Sunday is absolutely for spending time with your family, but it's also, the love of Christ reminds us, it compels us to remember that those who have no natural family to speak of, which is why the Lord's Day exists. The natural family is not eliminated in the kingdom of God. It expands. Sunday reminds us of this, because goodness and mercy are following us. Sunday is absolutely great for spending time enjoying the good things in life and creation, but they too must be enjoyed best from a place of rest. That's the goodness, mercy. Sunday is absolutely great for spending time enjoying the good things of creation, but it's also a great day for ministering to those who, for whatever reason, can't. The shut-ins, the poor, those who need encouragement. Goodness and mercy. Goodness and mercy weekly following us. Would the Lord instill in all of us the grace to receive this gift for what it is? It's a gift. The grace to receive this weekly reminder to look over our shoulders, weekly, that calendar reminder. We are calendar people. That calendar reminder to look over our shoulders at the goodness and mercy that doggedly is tracking us down. because of the faithfulness of our shepherd, Jesus, who still even now is Lord of the Sabbath. Let's pray.